everybody, and welcome to San Francisco Liberation Radio. On December 27, 2004, a delegation departed from the U.S., bound for the Iraq-Jordanian border, and carrying $650,000 of humanitarian aid for the people of Fallujah. The 11-member delegation consisted of several parents who had lost loved ones in Operation Freedom and the World Trade Center bombing: Amalia Avila, Nadia McCaffrey, Fernando and Rosa Suarez del Solar, and Adele Welty. Accompanying them were four members of Code Pink, the Women's Peace Movement: Medea Benjamin, Aria Shell, Jody Evans, and Gail Murphy. Henry Khalil, the organizing coordinator of United for Peace and Justice; Vivian Fayer, a psychologist and educator specializing in bereavement; and Dr. Jeffrey Ritterman, the chief of cardiology of Kaiser Richmond, made up the rest of the group. On February 8, 2005, the delegation presented the story of their week-long journey at New College in San Francisco, California. They talked about what they delivered, where they got it, how they delivered it, the group of Iraqi doctors they delivered it to, and how they and the Iraqis felt about the war. Sharing their grief forged personal connections, and this heart-to-heart communication made Families for Peace more than just another group delivering yet another batch of American aid to a country war-torn by American bombs. As I listened to their story, it became clear to me that the Americans and the Iraqis had made an heroic beginning toward healing the emotional and physical wounds of Operation Freedom. Feelings of brotherhood were born, and these feelings are a vital step toward peace in the Middle East. They were born in a climate of extreme danger to all involved. Part one begins with John Garfield of New College introducing Medea.
Okay, welcome everybody. I'm going to just say a few short words of welcome and then turn the mic over to Medea for this very important event. My name is John Garfield and I'm with New College. New College has been here for about 35 years working under the banner Education for Social Change. We have graduate and undergraduate humanities programs of all sorts, a public interest law school, graduate psychology. If you're interested in learning more about the school, we have literature out on the table, or you can check the website, newcollege.edu, newcollege.edu. So I'm John Garfield. I'm with the Center for Education and Social Action and the Media Studies MA program here at the college. And it is now my privilege to introduce Medea. Medea needs no introduction. She's the co-founder of Global Exchange, co-founder of Code Pink, recently returned from the delegation to the Iraq border in Jordan, the Families for Peace delegation that you'll be hearing about that delivered more than $650,000 in humanitarian aid to refugees made homeless. And Medea gets around. She was at the World Social Forum, she was protesting the Bush inauguration, and she's been to many, many other places, and she needs no introduction. So it's my pleasure and privilege to turn the mic over to Medea Benjamin.
It was really nice when you clapped when John said 650,000, because it really was you that raised that. I won't ask you personally if you contributed, but what was amazing to us is that after so many of us worked so hard to try to defeat Bush, and we sort of knew that Bush was going to use this as a, quote, mandate to go in and level the city of Fallujah, when it happened, we were all just sort of catching our breath from the election, and the anti-war movement was not able to respond. And many of us felt devastated that we weren't able to respond. And among those who felt the most devastated was a group that we have been working with very closely, and that is parents whose children have been killed in Iraq. Many of them are part of the group Military Families Speak Out. They've unfortunately have something in common that sets them apart from just military families. And because of that, they've started a new organization called Gold Star Families for Peace. And one of those people you might have heard of, Fernando Suarez, somebody who has been, since the death of his son, going around the country and actually around the world speaking out and saying, I don't want anybody to go through what I have gone through. The best way that you can support the troops is get them out of this illegal, immoral war and bring them home. Fernando felt devastated after November 2nd, and we were talking about what we could do, and looking at the devastation of Fallujah, we said, why don't we organize a family, a delegation of families who lost their children in this war, and take humanitarian aid to the refugees of Fallujah. And we use the Code Pink website. How many of you are on the Code Pink website? So for those of you who aren't, please sign up. It's codepinkalert.org, and we send out really awesome alerts. And it's very welcoming of men, so please join. And we hadn't raised a lot of money ever on the Code Pink website. We're not MoveOn, we're not huge, we can't raise, you know, massive amounts of money. So we thought that a pretty significant goal for us would be to raise $20,000 over the website. We put it out, and I think, Claire, in less than, wasn't it less than 24 hours, we had surpassed that goal. And we were really excited and decided, well, let's up it, and decided to go for $100,000. And we surpassed that goal. And then we had people calling us with medical supplies that were extremely valuable. We had teachers who got their children to make these beautiful, beautiful quilts for Iraqi children. We had a local toy company that gave us the most awesome toys of these finger puppets, piles and piles of them. And we realized we had struck a chord with our community. And the letters that we got, we brought a stack of them with us, were from people like high school students. There was one young girl who was who grew up on a farm, 12 years old, and said that she saves her money all year long by selling eggs, and at the end uses her literal nest egg to buy her Christmas presents. And it was $75, and this year she was giving the whole thing to send to us for the refugees of Fallujah, and said, please help us to heal our wounded country here in the U.S. by doing this. And these kinds of letters poured in with people saying, thank you so much for giving us the opportunity to express our absolute disgust at the U.S. policy, our shame at the U.S. policy, and to show a positive face for the Iraqi people and the Arab and Muslim people around the world. And I think that's one thing we were able to do, because we left on December 26th, and on December 20, it was the day that the tsunami struck. And we don't know whether we would have gotten press coverage, mainstream press coverage in the United States, larger than what we did get, if it had not been for that very tragic event. But what we do know is that as soon as we arrived in the airport and got off the plane, and then the entire time, we were surrounded by press from the Arab world, by Al Jazeera, by Abu Dhabi, by the Iranian press, by station that the U.S. set up, Al Huru, known as Freedom. They followed us around. And in the end, they became, all of them, our really good friends. And what amazed them is that there were Americans who wanted to show their compassion towards the Iraqi people. And they were particularly amazed that within this delegation were people who had lost their children. And I think just let's take a moment to recognize what kind of person it does take to have lost a child and use that grief and that suffering, and how it is so natural for a person who lost a child to say they lost them for a really worthwhile cause, that their child was a hero, that this war was the right thing, that we are liberating the Iraqi people. It's very, very hard for somebody to really look very closely at what this war is all about, and with the loss of a child, to recognize that the most important thing they can do is stop the killing of both the Iraqi people and stop the killing of more young men and women. And so I want to recognize tonight somebody who is with us who went on the trip, and that is Amalia Avila. Amalia lost her son in October, and it was so raw that when Fernando said, "I know this woman, Amalia, who would like to go with us," I was really amazed and said, "Well, let me talk to her. I don't know whether she really understands how difficult a trip it's going to be, not just physically, but part of the trip was that Iraqis were going to come meet with us and tell us about the destruction of Fallujah, tell us about the torture in Abu Ghraib, tell us firsthand testimonies about how they have suffered at the hands of the occupying forces. And when we talked to Amalia, she totally understood what this trip was about. She totally felt an absolute need to go on this trip. And so I'd like to pass the mic now over to Amalia, and please let's give her the welcome she deserves.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Amalia Avila, and I lost my son October 13 last year. He was killed in Iraq. He was in Ramadi. And the organization invited me to go with them in this trip. It was a wonderful trip. I understand a lot of things. I have a lot of answers for the question I have when my son died. And now I know everybody is...
I understand that everybody is suffering.
But after I talk to these families and see the condition where they are living, I know everybody is the same. I mean, they have the same pain as we do. And we have a lot of things to do to end this war. Because my son, when he left to Iraq, he told me he is going to... he has a mission. He had a mission to finish. But he couldn't finish because he died very young. And now, well, I'm doing my best to save these children, because for me are children. No, I'm sorry. I can explain to you. Okay, cuando mi hijo partió a Iraq.
When my son left for Iraq.
Él tenía una misión que hacer.
He had a mission to accomplish.
Porque a él le hicieron creer que iba a salvar a su país.
Because they led him to believe that he was going to save a country.
Y él decía que yendo a Irak iba a ayudar a toda esta gente, y él pensaba, se sentía tan grande que decía que iba a acabar con esta guerra.
And he went to Iraq feeling very big with this mission that he was going to save the people of Iraq and end the war.
Porque él quería que todos sus compañeros, todos sus hermanos regresaran a casa. Él no los quería ver allá.
And he wanted all his comrades in the military to come back home. He didn't want them to stay there.
Pero no fue así. La muerte le sorprendió la mañana del día 13 de octubre, y ahí terminó todas sus ilusiones y todos sus anhelos.
But it didn't work like that. Death found him on October 13th, and he wasn't able to fulfill his desires and his dreams.
Ahora, conociendo más a fondo por qué es esta guerra ¿Y por qué nuestros soldados van allá?
Now that I understand more what this war is about and why our soldiers are being sent there.
Yo puedo luchar por lo que él quería hacer, por el ideal que él tenía, no con un arma, simple y sencillamente con mi presencia y mi voz.
I can fight for the ideals that he stood for, and not with weapons, but with my presence and my voice.
Y de esta manera, pues, yo me he envuelto más y cada día conozco más sobre esto. Entonces, la meta que yo me he propuesto es abrirle los ojos a todos aquellos que creen en las mentiras que este gobierno les está diciendo.
And that's why I've become more and more involved, and my mission is to go out and educate people and open their eyes to the lies of this administration.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
I want to recognize the others who are here from the group. You will hear from Dr. Jeff Ritterman a little later, and Vivian Fayer, who's over there, and Arié Schell, who's going to show us some of the pictures from the trip. So the other person who went with us, in addition to some other family members, including Nadja McCaffrey, who lost her son, Patrick, in Iraq as well, is a woman from New York who lost her son as a firefighter on September 11th. And that was another piece of the puzzle that became part of the presentation that we made to the Iraqis and the Jordanians and others we talked to of this woman, Adele Welty, saying that she did not want her son's death to be used as an excuse for the perpetual wars of the Bush administration. So now we're going to hear from Arié Schell, who is an educator, an activist, a performance artist, has worked for many years with groups like Art and Revolution, and since not only raised lots and lots of money and medicines, but also has been working tirelessly since she's back home.
First of all, I just want to say what an honor it was to be a part of this delegation. It's an incredibly emotional experience for everybody, and just a really epic moment to be in a room in the middle of a war and occupation that's raging, and to be with families from both sides that have lost their loved ones and have suffered so much, and came together to share stories and to use their grief, as Medea said, to come together to bring peace. And what struck me really deeply being there is realizing the risk that the Iraqis had taken to come out, not only to travel the road, which is extremely dangerous now, but for many Iraqis to be associated or seen as potentially collaborating with an American, they're risking their lives. And for the doctors to leave their jobs, you know, when there's such a demand for their presence, that they risked their lives to come and be with us and share their stories and their testimonies, because they felt it was that important for us to carry these stories home to you. So, you know, I came home with this incredible moral imperative to share their testimonies, to bring the truth home, because we're certainly not seeing it in the media. So I'm going to share a number of slides. Most of the information has either come from the Iraqis that we spoke with or from the reports and photographs that Dar Jamail has taken. He's an unembedded independent journalist. Many of you have probably heard or read his reports. He's on Democracy Now! And Flashpoints, Free Speech Radio News. So a lot of this information is coming from him, and then there are also some photographs of the delegation, and I'm going to be sharing some testimonies that I transcribed during the meetings that we had, so that you can hear their testimonies actually in their words, not in mine. Many of you have heard that there have been over 100,000 Iraqi casualties at this point since the invasion. But that does not count the casualties that come every day through the loss and the shattered infrastructure that the Iraqis are having to suffer on a daily basis. So I'm going to describe some of that. This is an image of the raw sewage that runs through the streets. Many of you probably know that Bechtel was given a $680 million contract, and then again another $350 million. This is a fixed fee contract, which means that they get paid no matter what they actually do on the ground. And they're supposed to be rehabilitating the water treatment plants. None of this is happening. Iraqis at this point have very little access to clean water. They're having to get their water from mud puddles from the Tigris River, which is filled with unknown quantities of depleted uranium, heavy metals, pesticides, fertilizers, raw sewage, and there have just been massive outbreaks of cholera, hepatitis E, kidney stones, diarrhea, nausea. So this is a really severe crisis throughout Iraq. This is a picture of the wait for Iraqis to get gas. It's now about a two-day wait for them to get gas at the pumps. I heard that it was in the last 6 weeks before the election, there was a 400% increase in the price. Pre-invasion, it was 5 cents per liter. Now it's about 50 dinars per liter at the pump, and on the black market, about 1,000 dinars. So Iraqis are paying about an average of a little over $3 per gallon for their own oil. They are also suffering from a lack of electricity. They get maybe 2 to 6 hours a day. Most of Baghdad is being run on generators. And so families, you know, it's winter time now, so in order to heat their homes, a lot of them are being forced to burn oil. And so there's been a 300% increase in burn victims. Home raids are occurring on a regular basis, basically at 1 or 2 in the morning. Soldiers will come, use sound bombs or use the tanks to tear down the front gate. They will come into the house with their boots and their guns, turning everything over, often looting the belongings. They come in looking for fighters. If there is a male of fighting age, they will be hooded. They're being detained in often Abu Ghraib, where they're being held. The families have no idea what they're being charged with. It's very difficult for them to get information. They'll be held for anywhere from 6 months to a year to longer, where the torture is continuing to happen in a systematic way. So this is the daily terror that Iraqis are having to live with. They go to bed with full dress in case their home is going to be raided in the middle of the night, and the soldiers are often killing their livestock on their way out. And so this is a huge issue. I'm going to talk a little bit about some of the illegal weaponry that's being used. This is a tank armored with depleted uranium. Depleted uranium was used a lot during Gulf War I, and they're continuing to use it. Depleted uranium is an extremely heavy metal. It's about 1.7 times more dense than lead, so it's unusually has this unusual ability to shield or penetrate other metals. It has a radioactive half-life of 4.5 billion years. DU is easily when it burns, it releases submicron ceramic particles that are easily digested and breathed. 4 billions of years, the soldiers are not told about this. Of course, the Iraqi civilians are not told about this. So a lot of them, you know, with 70% unemployment now in Iraq, you know, they'll come to the tank to take the scrap metal, recycle it into spoons or cooking pots. There have been alarming rates of miscarriages and birth deformities, and one of the doctors who was on the delegation told us that there have been 9 reported cases of babies being born without eyes. These are fleshettes, which litter the ground, and they are also considered an illegal weapon. they embed hundreds of little darts or nails. They explode inside the body. This is an image of a cluster bomb victim. There are about 200 to 300 bomblets inside a cluster bomb that splatters out about 200 by 400 meters. So there's an extremely high civilian casualty rate with the use of cluster bombs. This is a garbage dump that refugees have made their homes. This is a family living there trying to make a fire to cook some food. Obviously, there's no water, electricity, or heat. And many of the images from this particular dump, there were flies everywhere. And the ironic thing is, this is one of the t-shirts that we've passed out there. It says progress and prosperity. This is one of the men who's now living in the garbage dump. So I'm going to say a little bit about the hospitals, because I know Jeff is going to go more in depth with this. But the hospitals, many of them have been bombed, have been looted, raided. There are continual raids where the military will go in and drag out the wounded men of fighting age. And the doctors just reported really deplorable conditions that they have to work under. There's just an extreme shortage of medical supplies and equipment. They're having to see 200 to 300 patients a day. There's no heat or electricity in a lot of the hospitals. And yet, the reconstruction that we did was, this is the main hospital in Baghdad. We painted it a nice coat of pink and blue on the outside, but if you can go to the next image, on the inside, they're having to put 2 to 5 babies in one incubator. This is in the intensive care unit. You know, it's the doctors, you know, once they started talking and sharing, you know, after the meetings were over and they gave their official reports, I remember Dr. Omar would pour out his frustration, what he has to deal with. You know, the families come in with these extreme wounds, praying that the doctor is going to be able to do something, and they have very little equipment, pain medication, antibiotics, they have nothing to work with, so they're also having to face the despair and the rage of the families. Doctors are also facing being kidnapped because of the 70% unemployment rate. Kidnappings are very rampant. It's a business. And so there's just been an extreme brain drain of doctors being afraid to even come in or not able to work under the conditions they're having to work under. This is an image of an ambulance windshield. And this is one of many pictures that I've seen. One of the women who was on the delegation told us she was in one of these ambulances. The snipers will shoot. You can also do the next image. You can see the bullet holes in the back. This is in case there are fighters or under suspicion that the ambulance is carrying a fighter. But we also heard many stories. One woman who was pregnant, had been shot by a sniper and was being carried to the hospital in an ambulance. The ambulance was also shot. So this happens on a regular basis. I'm going to talk a little bit about Fallujah. Basically, Fallujah has been leveled completely. What buildings are standing are riddled with bullets or half-bombed. Schools, hospitals, these are civilian homes. During the siege, you know, families were not able to go out into the streets because they were basically, the U.S. snipers were shooting anything that moved. So they couldn't bury their dead. They would bury them in their gardens or they were forced to leave them in the streets. This, you know, 60%, there were 300,000 refugees from Fallujah, but 60% of the casualties were women, children, and old men. This is an image of a body being left in the streets. It was half eaten by dogs. There are many, many of these photographs on DAR's website. One of the women that we were with brought these photographs out. There is a lot of evidence of the use of chemical weapons and phosphorus weapons, stories of mushroom clouds of people's bodies catching on fire, and even with water not being able to put the fires out. You know, this is what we're using in Fallujah. I'm going to share some of the testimonies that we heard. This is Mohammed. He's a physiotherapist with four children, extremely soft-spoken, very kind man, and I'm going to share this testimony from him. He said, "This happened 7 to 8 months ago. American soldiers raided a house looking for two brothers. The men weren't there, so they arrested one woman and went looking for her sister, who was in a car with her two daughters. They arrested everyone. The next day, they came back for the men. One was an alcoholic and was very weak. They heard that he was dead. His family went to ask for the body. The military lied and said he was not dead. One Iraqi woman began to help the family to seek information. It took 4 months before they received the body. We went to get the body from the base, and they sent us to the morgue so the father could get his son's body. At the morgue, the body was in a bag the Americans use. When we saw the body, it was almost black, and we could see some signs of the torturing on the body. We could recognize him little. The signs were the handcuff marks on his hands and also marks on his neck and signs on his legs and back. There were burn marks on the skin. They used an iron to burn him. 2 months later, the two sisters were released. They were very afraid to talk because the soldiers told them if they did, they would be arrested and tortured again. After a few days, one woman finally began to tell what had happened to them. She told me they brought the dead body of the brother and left it in front of them for 10 to 15 minutes. They made them strip naked, then brought the body in and left it there. They did this repeatedly almost every day. The women were taken naked to the main cells in the jail. After this, the Iraqi soldiers and American soldiers raped the women and did very bad things and shameful for us. There was not one part of their body they did not violate. They did this continuously. Now she does not go out. She told me she went to the Council of Religious Sheikhs to ask them to give her permission, a fatwa, to suicide, to kill herself because she couldn't live with the shame." This is Isam. He is a journalist, an Iraqi journalist. Lovely man. I'm going to share his testimony in his words. "All three times I was detained by American forces, tortured. The second time I was detained 17 days. They tied my hands and blindfolded my eyes and used plastic hand ties, and it hurt very much. I was handcuffed for 4 days straight. They only opened the hands for 15 minutes when they offered us a meal. My hands were tied for 4 days behind my back, even while I slept, and I was blindfolded the entire time. It was hard to sleep because we only had a wooden board, very skinny, and of course our hands were tied. The second time I was with 9 other detainees, and then they transferred them, so I was alone. It was raining and cold, and the jail was wet. One of the Americans came in, and I tried to remove my blindfold with my knees. He shouted at me to put it down, but I couldn't, so he hit me. The third time I was detained only 5 to 6 hours, 1 month ago. One of the INGs put his cigarette off on my hand to torture me. None of those arrested knew why they were arrested or when they would be released. Plus, when they released us, they took us to farms or the desert and dropped us off there. Nobody arrested me during Saddam's time. Everybody knows that Saddam was bad, but now we realize that we felt better and more safe then under the occupation. Even simple people now prefer Saddam, and I'm feeling this way too. I filmed a woman at her son's grave. She told me they raided her house and couldn't find one of her sons. They had already killed one of her sons 2 months before when he was fishing in the river. Witnesses saw him shot by an American sniper. So when they arrested her second son, she held him because she didn't want him to be taken, so they shot him in the shoulder. They took him from her and put him on the ground and stepped on his wound until he bled to death. They held him there until he died. They held him on the ground under their boot in front of his mother. He was looking at her the whole time until he died. This was 3 months ago. Why are they here? What can I say? To bring freedom? This is our friend Salam, who's going to be coming to join us in the East Bay. Salam, when I first got to Jordan, I came a few weeks before the delegation, and he was going to be joining us about a week after I had arrived, but we received a phone call that he was on his way because he had received a death threat. He had gone to deliver some aid to a widow with 8 children, got a phone call that he was collaborating with Americans and they were going to kill him. So he didn't take it very seriously, but a friend of his said, no, you have to take this seriously. Let me take your car and go check on your family. Well, his friend went, and they shot at his car 3 times. His friend was injured, but okay. And so Salam left that night with the clothes on his back and his computer, and that was it. So he recently was able to obtain a visa and will be joining us in about a week's time. Hopefully you'll get a chance to meet Salam. I'm going to share his story with you. This is the last testimony. I come from a family that is fighters against Saddam. Saddam discriminated against my family and our whole tribe, thousands of us. My brother is a sheikh. He is a religious man in Hilla. He used to make sermons during Saddam's time against Saddam. He was detained for speaking against Saddam. On May 1st, he was making a speech in Hilla at the Human Rights Organization. It was an open-door meeting and many people were there. The Americans raided the place and made everyone lie down. They randomly shot 9 people and injured them. Then they put 2 people on the wall and executed them by shooting them in the head. These were religious people. They then detained my brother and 1 other person. We could never get information from them. We got inside information from Abu Ghraib after 3 months that he was there. They gave us information that he was there, but they did not tell me if he was okay. They gave his sequence number because they give them numbers instead of names. I spoke English, so I could at least ask questions. Most people there could not even ask questions. They would not charge my brother with anything, and for 3 months they set appointments, then canceling them. After 3 months, I met with him, and he was now paralyzed in his arm and leg because he had been shot by a taser, which is high-voltage electricity. They also kept him in solitary in a black box, small as body size, for many weeks. They interrogate him 5 times a day. Now he is still detained with no charge for 7 months now. The only answer I have received is that they will review his case in 1 year. So this is part of Salam's incredible story. Because Salam had polio as a child, he has a disability. He gets around great on his crutches, but his legs basically don't function. And we're going to really need to cast the net in terms of supporting him while he's here for transportation, you know, place to stay, jobs, anything like that. So if anyone has time or interest in helping to support him, please come see me afterward. And he's an incredible, he's a wizard, techie, amazing, amazing computer guy. So these are some images from the delegation. We just shared photographs, stories, tears. On the evening of New Year's Eve, we held a peace vigil, which was quickly ended by the Jordanian police. And I just wanted to show a couple of pictures of the medicines that have been bought and delivered with the money that you all have helped to raise. We had boxes and boxes and bags and just so many duffel bags that were carried in to the refugees in Fallujah. And, you know, the doctors and the Iraqis expressed a lot of gratitude to what we were able to bring, you know, the little bit of relief. But really what they asked us for is to do everything that we can to end the occupation so that they don't have any need for these medicines. And I would like to end by sharing a quote from Fernando. This was in response to a sheikh who had come out to share his testimony. His son-in-law had been killed a week prior. He heard that we were coming, and so he made the journey to share his testimony with us. And this is one of Fernando's responses. He said, "We are united here in our grief, the pain of having lost a loved one, having lost a part of our lives. The grief has to unite us instead of separate us. I would like to ask those of you who are here to consider me your friend. I plead with you that we do something together to stop all of the destruction. No matter what I do, my son is not going to come back. No matter what I say, your own suffering is not going to change. But we can hopefully avoid that other people suffer what we have suffered."
This is the end of part one of What's Really Happening in Iraq, a presentation by the members of Families for Peace at New College in San Francisco, California, on February 8, 2005. In part two, you will hear from Dr. Jeffrey Ritterman, who gives the medical perspective on the situation in Iraq. Also, Medea Benjamin will tell about Code Pink's plans for March 19, 2005, and other upcoming civil disobedience. This is Carmen LaSalle for San Francisco Liberation Radio, a 24/7 internet radio station found at www.liberationradio.net. Code Pink's website is www.codepink4peace, that's Code Pink number 4 peace.org. Music in this production is by Chris Potter and Late Bake Productions. Thank you very much for listening.